Welcome to episode 148 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my special guest for today is the author Brian Abrams, who has a brand new film book dropping this week, You Talking to Me? The Definitive Guide to Iconic Movie Quotes. Joining me from New York City, Brian, welcome to Junk Filter.
Hello.
Brian, we're going to talk about your new book, but you wanted to come on the show to talk about a slept-on Sam Peckinpah film, a movie that I had never seen, 1972's rodeo drama Junior Bonner, starring Steve McQueen, Robert Preston, Ida Lupino, and the god Joe Don Baker.
Yes, and I've been bugging you in the DMs for like 2 or 3 months to talk about this movie, and it made me very happy that you were into doing it. And it is definitely one of my favorites, although I have this sort of I have this absurd contrarian resistance toward ranking, and I think it's just stupid. However, with Peckinpah, I will do it. And I think that Junior Bonner has taken the number 2 slot for me. I think it's just moved past Straw Dogs into number 2. I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah.
And the Wild Bunch obviously is number 1.
Obviously, number 1. You can't touch that. Yeah, so for me it's like Wild Bunch, Junior Bonner, Straw Dogs. This is where it gets tough. Then you have The Getaway and you have Ride the High Country and Alfredo Garcia. Like, then those three kind of battle it out, and everything else I'm not interested in. Although I would like to see Cross of Iron on the big screen. I want to give that another shot. That's where I'm at.
There never was a horse that couldn't be rode. There never was a cowboy that couldn't be thrown.
Famous old saying, right?
Steve McQueen as Junior Bonner. He has only one problem: the 20th century.
Boys, times have changed.
Peckinpah was very prolific in the 70s. I think he made something like 8 films: Cross of Iron, The Killer Elite, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Convoy. Have you seen Convoy, Brian?
I have seen them all. If I can try to give a concise bio on Sam Peckinpah for the podcast, would that be serviceable at all?
Of course.
Is that useful to us? I feel like if we look at Sam Peckinpah or if we hear his name, what do we think of? We think of slow-mo, action, shoot 'em up. Like, that sort of aesthetic seems like he's owned that particular camera trick. There's been versions of it before and after, but he's kind of, that's his signature. And we think of Westerns and we think of like gritty men who have been fucked over by the world, but they also understand that that is the world and that's just the way things are. So it's like a black pilled kind of universe for everybody. So he was born out of like a wealthy family in the Fresno area, state level politicians. I do think his grandfather was a congressman. He admired like his sort of macho relatives and kind of wanted to mold himself after that. But he was, you know, he was chasing girls. He was directing plays in like college and after. And I think one of his relatives made him a phone call and got him into TV. And he quickly like was under the mentorship of Don Siegel in the 1950s, who a lot of people know for, you know, amazing action films like Dirty Harry, I guess is the top one that comes to mind, but there are tons more. But he is responsible for creating like The Rifleman and The Westerner. And The Westerner is on Prime, and I do recommend it. Like, it's, you do see early on where he's like taking a macho Western landscape and figuring out a way to put melodrama in it and put depth in characters that I'm sure was like not commonplace for then. Everything else was like Bounty Law or whatever from right from the Tarantino flick. But you know, he moved on into movies in the 60s. I think his second film, Ride the High Country, was when he was able to really put a stamp on things. The first movie, it's like, I think his producer kind of like had his claws in it too much. And so he's kind of disowned that one, The Deadly Companion. So you can skip that. Ride the High Country is this beautiful, kind of the first of the revisionist Westerns where you start to feel things change and get out of the old fashioned stuff. That was critically acclaimed. That was like on a lot of top 10 lists. And then that gave him the chance to direct like mainstream studio stuff. Like, what's the one with Charlton Heston?
That would be Major Dundee.
Right. I was about to say Colonel Sanders, Major Dundee. And the other one was The Cincinnati Kid, which he got fired from. And Major Dundee was this like, he went over budget and his ego was out of control. And so that he became like the problem director and like kind of went away for a little bit. And he started he directed like some TV stuff and that kind of got him back. And The Wild Bunch was it was a major comeback. And it was also because Warner Brothers, they wanted a piece of a couple of things like Bonnie and Clyde. They wanted like that was happening and they wanted to kind of redo that. And also Butch Cassidy was out there and they wanted to compete with that. So there was this new feeling of like, oh, we need Westerns that the kids will go see. And Peckinpah just kind of seized that and did what he wasn't worried about what the kids would see. He wanted to just like make his crazy vision, right?
How I think of Sam Peckinpah as a filmmaker is that he, first of all, he helped to kill the actual Western with The Wild Bunch. Yeah. He put a pin on it in terms of the genre. The Wild Bunch is sort of the last time that you can make a traditional Western. Everything after The Wild Bunch to me is a neo-Western or a revisionist Western. And why I consider The Wild Bunch to be a transition is because it is made with that sort of old studio flair, and it feels like a traditional Western in many respects. It's a movie that is a response to America falling apart in the late 60s and the Vietnam War. Peckinpah basically decided to sort of show it for what it is. By the 60s, filmmakers who explored the Western genre started revealing how the sausages were made in some respect, mm-hmm. like sex and violence and brutality and racism. You know, the things that weren't talked about until the ratings started to allow for that kind of expression in American cinema. And so Peckinpah basically took it to the nth degree. And there was a sort of a 1-2 punch for Peckinpah in that period, because The Wild Bunch was followed by a more genteel film, The Ballad of Cable Hogue, and then mm-hmm. Straw Dogs, which, of course, right. everybody freaked out about. How do you feel about Straw Dogs? I know it's a difficult movie for me. I'm aware of how well it's made, but it's just so incredibly unpleasant.
Yeah, I realize that saying I love it is like a problematic sentence of itself. Like you can't like say that about Straw Dogs, but it is a gripping movie. There's no question about it. We're dancing around the rape scene is what you're, that's the disturbing sequence, right? And Pauline Kael's review, like that's like, she was the first, she was like the highest authority. And also, by the way, with a lot of credibility, like she championed Peckinpah mm-hmm. throughout his entire career. She considered him one of her lost boys, I think is what she said. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she found it to be this, I think her phrase was like a fascist work of art. And if you read her review, she's admitting that she struggles with the experience because she saw it as an artistic achievement, but she hated what was sort of what was underneath, the misogyny underneath it. You know, defenders of the film, for those who haven't seen Straw Dogs, I don't want to spoil it too much, but Dustin Hoffman is a sort of ostensibly like a beta math teacher, right? He's like a math teacher, isn't he? And he and his, I think, you know, and his younger wife, played by Susan George, beautiful younger woman, in the movie, the characters must be 15 years apart. They go back to her hometown in North England, mm-hmm. English countryside. And her, like the townsfolk sort of ravage and rape her. And there's this suggestion that she wanted it, and it's very controversial. But I've seen people write about how Dustin Hoffman's character pushes her toward that. I mean, that's as I understand the conversation. And you, if you watch it one time, you'll be like, ugh. And another time you'll watch it, you'll go, oh yeah, I guess I see it. Yeah. But it's tough. It's a tough watch. And
yeah.
But I admire it for what it is. I referred to his on-screen politics as black-pilled before. Like, that's how I see it. I don't think of it as reactionary. I see it as black-pilled because, and The Wild Bunch is the clearest example of, like, it's a movie that is saying, you know, the United States is a country that encourages free enterprise to the point where corporate overlords will just fucking crush everyone for nickels and dimes, right? And the Bill Holdens and the Ernie Borgnines, like the outlaws who were like, we're riding along with and we are rooting for, like, they perfectly understand that. And they know that you are on your fucking own. And there's like they do not think that collective bargaining is going to get them out of anything. Like, you know, like there is no mass organization in this scenario. And so that's how I think I see like I don't think it's cold. It's just like that anger. I think that's what it is. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he is a guy who's like, I don't think, like, I don't know if he would have voted for Trump or not. The problem is we also, when we get into the 70s, we have to talk about how like, the majority of those films, like he was drinking a lot in a lot of those films. And Junior Bonner, he apparently held back until after Five. But like Convoy, which you mentioned, I read that he was so blackout drunk on so many days of that set that James Coburn wanted, membership to the Directors Guild, and he was an old buddy of his, and he came on as assistant director and just like handled like tons of shots.
Yeah.
So if he was blackout drunk, he'd probably have voted for Trump and like in some angry stupor, some man child angry stupor, you know.
Heckinpah's big challenge after making The Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs was to be thought of as his nickname, Bloody Sam, as Mr. Violence. And I think that he, right after he finished shooting Straw Dogs, he jumped right into making Junior Bonner. And I think the goal was to make a movie that was as diametrically opposed to that kind of reputation as he could do. That he wanted to make it's practically a family film.
He definitely, I think, resented like the action filmmaker, label. He wanted to do more, but like that's where the paychecks were for him, and that's what people saw him as, right? I mean, look what came right after The Wild Bunch, right? Like The Ballad of Cable Hogue, which I have a hard time getting through. It's just kind of a goofy, sweet comedy with Jason Robards, who's another buddy of his. But yeah, he definitely wanted to expand. And The Getaway, which I think is like a really sharp, just kind of like middle of the road action flick. But if you look at it compared to like whatever your favorite like 80s actioners were, like you'll say, oh, there's definitely more craft in this, right? And he can't help himself. That's just, he brings it. He brings that artistry to even like a movie that I think he really approached as just a paycheck, because after Junior Bonner, McQueen and Peckinpah both needed a hit. And I think that was just like a straightforward, like sort of cash in for them. And that's what Pauline Kael said about it too. I happen to love it. Not as much as Junior Bonner, but.
Junior Bonner kind of came and went in its time. For one thing, there were four rodeo movies in the year 1972 alone, which I had no idea. So not only was there Junior Bonner, but there was also J.W. Coop with Cliff Robertson. There was a James Coburn comedy called The Honkers, which both, I think you can find The Honkers on YouTube, and also a Richard Widmark, Frederick Forrest movie called When the Legends Die. So the market was a little saturated with rodeo movies in 1972, which is funny as well, because one of the themes of Junior Bonner is that this is a entertainment circuit that owes more to America's past than America's future.
the Prescott, Arizona frontier days. I grew up in Texas. I was not hanging around like rodeo people or, you know, so McQueen is Junior Bonner. Steve McQueen is Junior Bonner in this. And he plays like a champion bull rider who's kind of at the end of his career, right? And his father, played by Robert Preston, is Ace Bonner. And he was also this like champion bull rider from like the previous generation. Neither one of them want to grow up, I guess, on one level, but they also just like refuse like a conformist life. They want to be stars, right? They want to be like they enjoy the celebrity of being a bull rider, the travel, the women, the drinking, the freedom. And meanwhile, Curly, played by Joe Don Baker, who is Junior's brother, either older or younger.
Younger brother.
He feels like the younger. Okay. Yeah.
He's pretty sure he's the younger brother. Even though McQueen's name is Junior, I detected Joe Don Baker's Curly to be even more Junior.
Yeah. And in the movie, in fact, someone asks McQueen, they're like, why are you called Junior? And he kind of shrugs. And I think, he they call him JR and Junior. And his name is not Ace. We don't really know his real name. I don't even know if his dad's real name is ever given. It just kind of doesn't matter.
What I interpreted Junior Bonner's name as being that they were maybe at one point a father and son rodeo team, and that he was the junior of Ace, and even if he was the older brother of Curly, that his initials JR were turned into the nickname Junior that he never shakes. But this is a guy who's clearly in his 40s at this point, still living a cowboy life and a mythical life. Ace is a little sadder in the respect that he still thinks of himself as that kind of cowboy hero. But these are two American archetypes that are wandering around in an America that is giving way from the frontier and the idea of Western expansion into suburbanization and gentrification, which is what Joe Don Baker represents.
Yes. So Curly totally buys into what's coming and he wants to cash in on that. And Ace, who he is still deluded about like where he is in life, but he's also like pulling desperate schemes with, mining for silver or,
He wants to move to Australia to be, to mine for silver. There's no more America to explore for guys like this. So the frontier is now the other side of the world.
Right. And so Curly, Joe Don Baker, pays him something like $15,000 for like all the plot of land that the whole Bonner family grew up on. So since his dad is always crapping out on like silver mine investments and the like and can't keep his shit together, and Ace and Junior are the same, these like dreamers, these adventurers, these bull riders, these womanizers. And you can tell Curly resents that status, that celebrified status and their recklessness. But he is relatable. I mean, all of these characters are human. There is no like quote unquote bad guy, right? Like he does have a plan to secure all this land and go into this major mobile home development business. And in turn, he wants all of his family members kind of under his wing, right? Mm-hmm. You could defend him by saying it's like well-intentioned of Curly that he knows he has fuck-ups for blood relatives. And that he wants to be in control of it all because he just knows that's what's best for everyone. And maybe there's a little spite in there too, right? And one more thing we should definitely add is the mom.
Yes.
Ace calls her Mrs. Bonner or Miss Bonner. And like they've been split up, but you can tell they still love each other. And Ida Lupino plays it like perfectly. Like she is to the T a woman who is not quite in her 60s. They're, she's playing a character in her 50s, I think, like Ace, or late 50s, maybe. And, you know, she's a woman who's tired of his shit, but still loves him for his, like, devilish charms. And she lives in, like, a house that Curly is also going to sell off. And he's going to put her in one of her one of his trailers. And she's going to, like, run the gift shop. But like she has to like listen to lectures from her daughter-in-law about not smoking around the baby, you know, because Curly and Curly's wife have like these three kids and, you know, they're like the ultimate like suburban breeders. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I love it. I mean, I find like that whole family portrait is like highly relatable. Right. $35 in Reno,
I couldn't get a decent ride. Lend me $15, man. You already owe me $25. Well, that's 40.
Neither me or my bull aim to make a living off another fella's pride. Now, you might as well face it. You're just not the rider you was a few years back.
I need it, Buck. It's my hometown. But I'll do all right in the frontier days,
unless all the good folks die. I'm working. I was raised in the town of Prescott. I got the whole world on my side, gonna win top money.
I'm a rodeo man. This is a Peckinpah movie that I don't think a lot of people who even like Sam Peckinpah know about. It's so obscure, but yeah. I think time has been exceedingly kind to this movie. I don't think in 1972 we had the Hangout movie that we do have today. And so Junior Bonner to me feels like a prototype for a movie like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in the sense that it's just hanging out with some people in this very, very well art-directed and lived in world. The stakes are a little bit higher ultimately in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but it also has Steve McQueen in it. I got some serious Cliff Booth vibes from Steve McQueen in this film. The competition looks at him as sort of yesterday's guy. There was a time where a guy like Junior Bonner had the world on a string, but you also get the sense that the money that he's riding rodeos for is getting smaller and smaller, and he's broke. You know, he even has to sort of meet with Ben Johnson's character, who sort of arranges for him to be able to ride this prized bull, and they're going to split the money together. So he has to work twice as hard for half the results that he used to be able to achieve. And the movie even begins with a split screen opening title sequence where we can see the physical toll that this life has on this man.
I love that you called it a Hangout movie, because I mean, I thought the same thing, and I had a more cliched parallel in my head when you talk Hangout movies. Like, I think, you know, Dazed and Confused is like the most obvious reference for the Hangout movie. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think of it as that because, you know, like that, what was that, 1976, I think, the High School Graduation. Mm-hmm. This movie is like equally confined to just like, you know, the small town of Prescott, Arizona, which, you know, the population, I had to look up the U.S. Census population for Prescott, Arizona around this time. 1970 had it around 13,600. I mean, that's like the exact population that you would think of in the Dazed and Confused town of, like, you know, the old folks going to see the junior high softball game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone just kind of knows everybody. And if you're divorced, then you will end up trying to flirt with the nurse who takes care of you while you're in the hospital. And she's going to want to dance at the bar from you later on that night.
The stakes are pretty small in this film. It's about an aging rodeo star who returns home. He's sort of hasn't seen his family in a long time. Home is not what it used to be. Dad is laid up in the hospital because he got into a drunken accident. Curly is selling mobile homes, and he sold off the family farm, and he wants to convert basically every member of the family into employees of his real estate empire. You know, he's trying to make money on the fact that the world that Junior Bonner used to rule over and Ace used to rule over is giving way to the suburbs and the suburban sprawl. It's interesting for Sam Peckinpah, who has made, you know, so many Westerns about the sort of the transition between old America and new America, and what you weren't told about what America used to be versus what you're now being told about what America is. Peckinpah was always interested in that and the effect of capitalism on the West and on America and on the American dreams being co-opted. You know, like, what is Junior Bonner's purpose at this point in this world? What, but he doesn't want to take a job working for Curly. You know, like he still wants to be his own man, but like the guys must be 43 at this point or something like that. Like, there's not much more future for him, but he's going to continue to go down the road to the next town. He wants one last triumph in his hometown, and he gets it too. Like, that's what I mean about the stakes not being very high in this movie. He does get what he wants, but this movie is more interested in the vibes of life in this town and a character study of a guy like this. It's got a good light sense of humor all throughout. I thought it was very funny, that scene where Curly is telling all the folks about this new exciting ranchero. So he's doing a bus tour for seniors and or people who want to put their parents in a home for this new retirement living center called Curly Bonner's Riata Rancheros.
So he has, so he and his wife like run some sort of store, like it's more than a gift shop. It's some kind of bullshit retail store for tourists or for whoever. And they have this like, and he has this decked out like bus that he's trying to get people aboard so that he can take them out to this, you know, the rolling hills of nothing where like these mobile homes are going to be. He's trying to like lock people in. Right. And there's this, and you're right. There's, I don't know if you can play that song on your pod. That'd be awesome if you could clip that. It is funny. I'm glad you caught that.
Well, the lyrics are, come on down the highway. It's the twilight of your life. It's like so depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it captures like, it definitely captures like the fun kind of good old boy spirit of like, you could picture like yourself, like just draining a day hanging out there and maybe you drink a few tall boys at the Palace Bar, and that cheesy music absolutely like exists there, right? And people just kind of nod along to it, like whatever. But you said that's, I'm so glad that you mentioned that it's not plotless, but it's difficult to put your finger on it or to write like a Leonard Maltin synopsis of it would be like, you would not be doing it justice, right? Mm-hmm. And I would even say it's tough to put it in a, if you worked at a Blockbuster in like the year 1989, like to figure out which aisle it belongs in is difficult because I would say, you know, for starters, people that went to see it, you know, who maybe, you know, wanted to see a sports movie about a bull rider, like the bull riding and the horsey shots are kept to a minimum, right? And so when you do see them, they count. But it's not a sports movie. I'd call it a comedy first, but that almost gives the impression like it's, you know, like a Burt Reynolds-y movie called like, you know, Cooter, Montana and the Okie Doke Choo Choo. Or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm, like it's not a Southern fried comedy. It's not action. It's got some drama in it, but it's hard to file. It's hard to put like a hashtag on that one, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hashtag Jesus, what year is this?
But the easiest categorization is Western, but it's also not really going to satisfy anybody who likes Westerns. It's a movie about the end of the West and how the West has been reduced in modern America. I mean, this movie came out just before Nixon's second term as, you know, that sort of Americana that has been basically like drained of all of its vitality.
Yeah.
Like this town is going through the motions. Like this is their big frontier days. This is the big thing that they look forward to every year. It must be a real festival that Peckinpah filmed in because it really does not feel like something they did for a movie. It feels like Peckinpah and his crew went to this town and used all the locals and filmed their actors in amongst the festivities. And I love also the way that Peckinpah uses the big Todd AO widescreen format to document this festival. It feels like a documentary, except so many of the shots are very, very well composed and use the entire widescreen.
Right. It's not, you don't get like a handheld feeling or like that it's captured footage, but you definitely you definitely feel like you're looking at faces that he found down there that captured the essence of what he wanted. Like there was, in the barroom fight, there's a 6'5" guy who's just kind of wandering around, and he's like half fighting, but more or less just kind of drinking beer. And there's a shorter Mexican friend of his who runs off into the bathroom to like hook up with like either more like one woman or two. I don't know. Like, but he's running around and he just like grabs him and sets him on the bar. And if you listen to their dialogue, it's just kind of them either trying to read lines as best they can or just coming up with shit as it comes to them. But mm-hmm. That is so okay. So since we're spoiling the entire movie for everybody, that is my favorite scene. But also, I love the slow-mo punch that McQueen gives Jodon Baker on the front porch after the dinner. That is a scene that I have hit rewind on several times. It cracks me up. It's a subtle movie. Like, and so when those little loud moments happen, I mean, it's satisfying to see it.
Well, Peckinpah's the god of slow motion. And, you know, the thing that I love the most about Peckinpah is his ability to bend time and to, you know, like he's famous for it in The Wild Bunch. But in the big scene at the end where he rides the bull, I got out the stopwatch because the thing about riding the bull is it's an 8-second ride.
On a half ton of fury.
But Peckinpah and his editors, through the magic of cross-cutting flashbacks and slow motion and seeing the same shot from 5 different angles, the bull ride takes 47 seconds.
Oh, that's terrific. I never thought of that. That's terrific.
He was the Christopher Nolan of his day.
Oh, God.
Did you know that Gene Hackman was the original choice for Curly, but Steve McQueen wouldn't agree to the salary demands?
So I did see that about Hackman. I did not realize that was why it didn't happen. I'm so happy it went to Jodon Baker, though.
Oh, I know.
Can we talk about Jodon Baker for just a minute?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he came into my life, I would say, when I was probably – I was either 13 or 14 when Scorsese's Cape Fear came out. And so – and I noticed him immediately as, like, he's a Texas boy. I grew up in Texas. I don't know if I mentioned that before. I apologize if I did. But he absolutely is that guy without sort of, he doesn't have to ham it up. I think he plays himself he comes across very natural in that way, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's, I do think he has, like, there is an intelligence about him in his performances, right? Like, even though he plays, like, you've seen him in 100 different things and he just plays like a bubba. Like, I don't know how to describe this. He's very aware that that's what he's playing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've always thought of him as like, and especially when you start watching him in the shit that like, Mystery Science Theater 3000, like dubs,
like
right? Like, Mitchell's great. And I say that unironically, by the way.
Yeah, no, Mitchell is wonderful. There will be a Mitchell episode of this podcast.
Oh, God, I can't wait. But there's also Final Justice is the other Mystery Science Theater one, which I don't know if you've ever seen that, where he like goes overseas. He's like I don't know what he is. He's like a sheriff and he's on some mission. I don't even remember what it is, but it's the funniest shit in the world when he has like this, I don't know, he has this standoff and, you know, they do like the very Leone like close ups. And one of the Mystery Science Theater guys just goes, the ugly, the ugly, and the ugly. and of course, Walking Tall, which is like, it's too long. It's like, if they could cut 30 minutes out of it, I'd like it a lot more. But he is like an authentic American action hero. And I say that with like nothing but the highest respect for the more iconic 80s action movies that we know. Like, I definitely regard, you know, that universe of Schwarzenegger and Stallone and Bruce Willis or whoever as like, I regard that as an art form. That's like a modern mythos for us. That's like the Paul Bunyan and the Blue Ox, you know, of our modern society. But an honest American action hero would be Joe Don Baker. Like, how tall? He's like 6 foot, 6 foot one, beer gut. He will punch your lights out. He can't exactly haul ass. He does not look good with his shirt off. But you know, he can fight, right?
Joe Don Baker, he feels like he came along at the wrong time. He would have been an incredible Coen Brothers stock player, for instance.
Yeah.
There's an absolute intelligence to his stupidity on screen, mm-hmm. I think.
Well said.
Interestingly, Joe Don Baker said that he did not like working with Sam Peckinpah.
Oh, on Junior Bonner. Did he say that?
Yeah. He said, "I didn't care for Peckinpah at all. He was one of those little guys who tries to bully big guys, and he almost got his ass whipped for trying to do it to me." McQueen apparently had to calm him down a few times. I think they took turns calming each other down while dealing with Peckinpah, because Peckinpah wasn't indeed not a very big guy. He was still super intimidating and a hard ass, but you know, eventually a guy like Joe Don Baker could just put him through a window like he gets put through a window in the movie.
I mean, I believe it. I mean, Peckinpah was a, you know, deeply insecure guy who chased women to sort of fill that void. I mean, that's basically what, you know, that happens a lot. We all sort of seek external validation in destructive ways sometimes, but we should probably talk a little bit about McQueen too. Right.
So Steve McQueen in this movie, I would say that I've almost never liked him more as a leading man than in this film.
I totally agree. With the this is probably, you're right. This is probably my favorite McQueen movie. I'm going to put Bullet up there too. Mm-hmm. And I have my problems with Bullet and I'm happy to discuss. Yeah, you're right. Like, this is a character that I think that I want to identify with McQueen. It's the least of him trying to be such a coxman. I mean, that's obviously who this character is, but you do get a sense that he's a human and that he's not this invincible prick that you see in a lot of his films, right? Is that a brash way of putting it?
Well, he's a loser in this film. Like, he's the guy who we want to root for. That's one of the perks of playing a loser. I read a quote from Howard Hawks that he said he didn't like Junior Bonner because the movie was about a bunch of losers, and I don't like losers.
That's great.
Maybe Hawks didn't like to see the Western turning into character studies of losers or something. To me, the fact that McQueen is playing this kind of outmoded character who is also a professional. And I also noticed that in this film, Peckinpah is very keenly aware of all the details of living a life like this. Like, you know, when the rodeo is over, you got to get the horse back into the wagon. And, you know, you got to buy some apples on the way to the next town to feed the horse and stuff like that. Like, this is what I mean. Like, nothing really important is happening in this movie, but it's so well observed, and McQueen is so, like, the word is laconic in this film, that it's just humming along. Maybe it seemed boring in 1972, but now it kind of feels like almost like a ethnographic film about what it was like in Arizona in the year 1972.
You almost could confuse it for if someone told you that, like, oh, this movie was made with, like, European influences.
Yes.
You could be like, oh, yeah, I guess I buy it, right? You could see it. And McQueen was – we should give him credit for this role because, you know, he was highly conscious of the roles he played and how he played them. And there was a biography of his I read – by Mark Elliott, who's one of these guys that writes like 25 biographies, but, you know, they're reliable enough. And, you know, he portrays McQueen as like a bit of a whiny diva between the ways that he sort of fought to expand his presence in The Great Escape and the ways that he also wanted to sort of control Bullet. That is that in The Great Escape, he felt that James Garner had more of a role than he did. And so he sort of lobbied to make sure that director John Sturges would like emphasize the motorcycle escape more, and also like the baseball mitt routine being getting in more shots. That was apparently McQueen's doing, making sure that happened. And that's obviously now like, you know, an iconic piece of 60s imagery. And Bullitt, you know, he wanted the film to be way more visual, and he also wanted to be laconic there and, you know, slim down tons of dialogue, which then left it to director Peter Yates to like figure out like how to visually explain what's going on in Bullitt, which is why it's such a confusing and incoherent movie. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, the car chase is still just amazing. So I take it as not just him being a diva, but I take it as him like really making an effort at shaping, you know, his portrayal. And that was him being like high maintenance, yes, but also like highly professional. And so that's my really roundabout way of saying like much credit to him for taking on J.R. Bonner and playing it in this kind of smaller, softer way.
Also much credit to McQueen for doing most of, if not all of his own stunts in the film. Like he actually is riding that bull. I was looking very carefully to see if it was the stuntman. Maybe in some shots it was, but when he finally wrestles it down, that's McQueen. And that can't be easy.
Oh, wow. And was that... was that Preston out there too in the wild milking
Probably
race?
Not.
Okay. And the dog, the yellow dog running out there with him.
Yeah. I love Robert Preston and I'd never thought of him as a Western guy, but I bought him in this film.
Oh, totally.
Like that sort of vainglorious man of the West. He's also a cautionary tale for Junior Bonner. Like, you know, you're going to be this eternal playboy. Your wife will eventually leave you.
Yeah, no, so Ace is right. So Ace is this guy who in the bar after the wild cow milking contest, you know, he bellies up, he takes a shot of whiskey, or maybe it's right before, I can't quite remember. But, you know, he mutters like, you know, his own drunken wisdom, which is he says, if this world's all about winners, what's for the losers, right? And, you know, Curly, meanwhile, over in the corner, you know, is sort of, you know, he's whispering to Junior Bonner that he's working on his first million while you're still trying to get 8 seconds, right? The father-son connection is really strong too. Like that's very believable. And I think McQueen absolutely, excuse me, like Junior Bonner knows what Ace Bonner is, and he still just chooses to take that path. He doesn't want to be Curly. He doesn't want to be a mobile home salesman, right?
The quote unquote family business in this film, like the options that are presented to J.R. Bonner are work for your brother in his mobile home empire that's destroying the actual landscape, or go with your dad, who's like in his late 60s, to go mining in Australia as another delaying tactic from growing up or something like that. So, you know, his choice is to just keep on doing his thing.
And Ben Johnson also offers him a job.
Yes.
Right? He like says, come along with me. I need like, you know, I need someone washed up to kind of help me take the youngsters on the road and ride bulls. Right? He doesn't want to do that either.
But all of the options that are ahead of him are these sort of degraded ideas about capitalism. And he decides to continue on and still do the rodeo circuit. But, you know, that's another delaying tactic. I mean, how long are you going to keep driving? That's the question that I sort of had at the end, even though it had a sort of vaguely happy ending because he gave his dad enough money to actually go off to Australia and go first class and patch things up more or less with his mom. You know, he's on to the next town. He's done everything that he set out to do when he arrived in Prescott. But, you know, can't you see from watching this movie that this way of life is pretty much done?
The happy ending is that, right? He doesn't want to find out what's next. He refuses to look. He'd rather just kick the can down the road, put the horse back in the trailer, you know, put the top down in the, is it a Cadillac that he drives?
Yeah, it's like an old junky Cadillac. And he's also got the horse carriage behind him, like that horse trailer.
Right, the tractor trailer or whatever it's called. And yeah, he would just assume hit the, where is he going? Las Salinas next. And then,
yeah, he's going to Salinas and then Fort Worth. He's just still doing the rodeo circuit, but, you know, it's a fun attraction, maybe in Prescott, Arizona, but like, you know, what's the future for Junior Bonner? It's not a negative ending. It's more of a, you know, again, with the Hangout movie vibes of this film, it's like, well, who knows where he'll go. Like, it's not down on the character for deciding to take this direction. It's just matter of fact. So
his only plan, yeah, he just wants to get Aerosmith tickets in Houston, right?
That's right.
That's it. Yeah.
But he rejects everything that has been presented to him, but actually everything that's been presented to him is rejectable stuff. It's not like he walked away from an opportunity. Everything that was being offered him were further examples of how what was once America is now a sort of tacky version of history. You know, it's like a sort of boring present. And Peckinpah turned out to be actually pretty right about that. This is what I mean about how the movie actually has better currency in this day and age. Also, I want to single out how good Ida Lupino is in this movie. This was her return to the big screen. She'd been in a lot of television through the 60s, including Batman. She was one of the villains on Batman. Before that, she was a kind of a pioneer in terms of film and television. She was only the second woman to be inducted into the Directors Guild after Dorothy Arzner. And she kind of backed into her directing career because she was really annoyed at her prospects as a Warner Brothers contract player, and who was mostly being offered the stuff that Betty Davis turned down. So she started turning stuff down too, started getting less work, started becoming more interested in film production. And then she wrote a screenplay for a movie, but the director got sick. So she stepped in to direct the movie. And that led to a very long and productive career in film and television.
Was that The Bigamist that she stepped into?
No, it was called Not Wanted. It was a screenplay that she wrote about an unwed mother. But she wound up directing the movie. And she did Outrage, which is excellent, and The Hitchhiker as well. She deserves more credit for her filmmaking. But she was also a terrific actress. But one fun fact about why Peckinpah cast Ida Lupino in this movie is that she was working on a series called Mr. Adams and Eve in 1957 for TV, and she found him living in a shack behind her property. So she hired him to work, and was one of the reasons why he became a film director was the leg up that Ida Lupino gave him, and he paid her back by casting her in this movie.
She was terrific in it. I know I said this earlier. Like, you do feel the strain on her in this movie, in the ways in which she loves Ace Bonner. She has not forgotten why she's connected to him. They've had two boys together. She also is so sick of his ass too. Right. And yes. She's trapped in this town, population 13,500 or whatever. And you know, there was a moment after the bar brawl, I believe Ace he's more of a child than JR in some ways, right? He's just deeper in denial, and he is funny and he is charming and he is a little bit of that Music Man sort of, not grifter, but I would describe it as like a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Huckster.
That's exactly the word I was thinking. He is like a huckster, you know, who's just kind of getting by in life by the day. She understands his charm. It reminds her of why they got together in the first place. But she does turn to him and she just says, like, dreams, sweet talk, that's all you are. And it's such a convincing expression she gives too. She has these wonderful eyes too, that are set kind of wide apart from one another. She's, you know, you feel her every sulk, and I'm always watching her whenever she's on the screen.
If this world's all about winners, what's for the losers?
We could have won. We did, Ace.
You're my brother. Man, I guess I love you. Gotta go down on the road.
I'll park my two-horse trailer up at the rodeo grounds and I'll start roaring. I'm a rodeo man.
Steve McQueen as Junior Bonner, the last of his kind.
You can easily imagine why this movie wasn't a success in June of 72 at its release. It was released not with the notion of doing like a sort of select city rollout and building buzz. They just kind of dropped it as a mass release to hundreds of theaters in the hopes that, you know, the general public would take it as like another Steve McQueen action movie. And it doesn't work that way. If people are expecting a Steve McQueen action movie, and they're not going to get it. And also, anyone who is following Peckinpah's work, it would be a letdown as well if they walk into that. That's not what necessarily they would be expecting either, right?
Junior Bonner and The Getaway are kind of like the A-B options. Like Peckinpah and McQueen made Junior Bonner. Nobody wanted it. Then they made The Getaway, which was more commercially viable. Hit movie, you know, so it's like, okay, I guess that's my future. Peckinpah never made anything as light as Junior Bonner until Convoy, which of course came sort of on the downward trajectory of Peckinpah's career, where he sort of turned into a cartoon version of himself. But his integrity is pretty much in place in Junior Bonner. He decided to make a movie that was like the inverse of what his reputation would suggest, right down to making a movie that actually was almost freeform in the way it was. It was like a documentary about 3 days in Prescott, Arizona with some rodeo riders.
Yeah, he once said, and I forget which interview this was in, but I made a film where nobody got shot and nobody went to see it.
So I want to read you a quote from the Playboy interview that came out around the time that Junior Bonner was released with Sam Peckinpah, where he was talking about Ben Johnson. And he said he thought the last picture show was, quote, artsy, craftsy, jacksy, offsy, and a real pain in the ass. I was supposed to have dinner one night with Ben Johnson, who was superb in it, but I knew Peter would be there and I'd have to hit him right in the fucking mouth, so I didn't go. I really hated that film. Playboy asked him, well, what films have you liked recently? And Peckinpah said, my own. I make marvelous films. I think Junior Bonner, which I shot in 40 days, may possibly be my best picture.
I should mention also in that same 72 Playboy interview, that Peckinpah responds to Pauline Kael's review for Straw Dogs, in which she calls it the first American film that is a fascist work of art or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And he just says that he mentions how, you know, the two of them have gotten together and have drank a lot and they were friends and they would hang out. And but in that instance, he said that she was, quote, cracking walnuts in her ass.
The interview with him is so funny. It has that classic line where Peckinpah is talking about his directing career. And he said, I'm a whore. I go where I'm kicked.
But I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, he's no. Obviously he doesn't go where he's kicked. And Kael, when The Killer Elite came out in 75, I think it was 75, she used her column to review The Killer Elite, which is not like, it's not worth watching.
Good start. Good start.
Yeah.
But then the ninjas come in.
It's just, forget it. But she knows it's not his best, but she talked about the things she liked in it, but she used that as an opportunity to praise him for being this, what she described as like a personal artist, and that he's not a whore who goes where he's kicked. If you hire him to take on a project, it's gonna become a Peckinpah project. Right. Mm-hmm. He's not the Hollywood hire. It's not what you're getting when you bring him on.
Well, Brian, we could talk about Sam Peckinpah all day, but you have a brand new book. The title is You Talking to Me, The Definitive Guide to Iconic Movie Quotes. This is a very, very dense and heavily researched and breezy read about how movie quotes become the sorts of things that everybody knows, including people who have never actually seen the movies that are being quoted. You know, like there's this phenomenon where we're all familiar with lines from movies just from having to swim through the culture that we all live in. And in particular, our very self-referential culture that we live in now, where everybody's supposed to catch the references all the time. You've gone back from the sound era all the way to the present. And it's very interesting to watch how quotes have a certain amount of currency in the time that they're said, and how some quotes stand the test of time, and also how quotes have become more accurate in our day and age, because in the olden days, people would quote movie lines that weren't actually lines from the movie. This was pre-videotape and pre-TV, so you were dependent on remembering and recalling lines of dialogue. And then when suddenly we had full access to the history of film, we started realizing that they don't actually say, "Play it again, Sam," in Casablanca.
You know? No, that's well put. I not to make too much of it, but like that's really that's a really nice description of the book's mission, if there was one. I mean, I think it does. I want it to work on a couple of levels where if you are just like a normal human standing who's, you know, heard all of these expressions, would you be shocked if I put on something more comfortable or mm-hmm. a martini shaken, not stirred, and never knew of their origins or their meanings or quite where they came from? Like, even if you are a movie buff, like there are things that you just still don't quite know where it's from. And so I just kind of want to like dig my hands in the sand there. Right. And just like, find their essence. And, It does date all the way up to now, you know, but of course, the more modern you get, I mean, honestly, the fewer the quote iconic lines you can discover. I feel like if I took a wrong turn with this book, it was that there aren't enough contemporary lines. But the truth is like, if you can make the distinction between like movies you love and know backwards and forwards, and therefore you know all the lines, and movie lines that objectively have somehow made an impact in the culture, mm-hmm. You know, have, you know, been reappropriated in sort of magnificent ways, or have just kind of ricocheted throughout. I mean, By Felicia in Friday mm-hmm. is like a key example of one that you can't exactly point to like some major moment in pop culture for it, but you can look at it and say, okay, this was a stoner comedy in 1995, and that was a throwaway line. That was not like going to be a piece of dialogue that they thought was going to be anything. And as it gained, you know, its cult following on video, you know, people's cousins, people's sisters, people's moms, people's aunts of the people who had those 2-foot glass bongs in the closet would mm-hmm. watch the movie. And like, suddenly By Felicia is being used in like black reality TV, and it becomes mm-hmm. this kind of sassy line. Right. And it takes on a life of its own. So, I wanted to dig into that aspect. And the second level, I think, is just purely if you are just a film fanatic, you will enjoy diving in. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of juicy stuff in there for just someone who wants to just geek out.
And there's some thematic sections as well, like, you know, the Scarface is a movie with lots of quotable dialogue, and it's kind of in a little constellation along with you know, other sort of quotable crime films of that period.
I like among the thematic sections that you're referring to, like, yeah, there were, you can't just do like movie lines in chronological order and have like, you know, just text following them. You got to break it up. And I also want it to be a pick up and put down read. Like, it's not like, I'm not trying to take it too seriously either. So like, you know, it is a toilet tank book in a lot of ways, or a coffee table book in a lot of ways, where you can just kind of get to it as you feel like it. And it's not a big commitment. It'll be there for you for 2 or 3 months. Right. Mm-hmm. But the thematic sections were fun. I mean, there were, so like examples, Universal Horror from the 30s, baseball comedies of the 80s. You can kind of break these up. Certain directors required their own sections. Billy Wilder has his own section because he's just sort of, you know, I guess, you know, it doesn't get much better than that. Mel Brooks, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think that like my favorite thematic section might be one I titled Trashy Delights, and it dives into camp. And I focus on What Will You Give Me for a Basket of Kisses from The Bad Seed, 1956. No Wire Hangers from Mommy Dearest. And then Thanks, I Got It at Versace from Showgirls. And, you know, I also take the opportunity to use Susan Sontag's essay Notes on Camp from the 60s to kind of just once again clarify its definition, because it is this term that's been thrown around so much that it's just one of these descriptors that's come to mean everything and nothing. But she did have a specific aesthetic and attitude and action in mind for it. And those three lines, I think, can really talk about it.
I notice that your book is dedicated to a friend of yours, the late great actor Taylor Negron, who made an impression on me in one of my favorite movies, The Last Boy Scout, as one of the main henchmen, Milo. You want to talk about a movie with lots of quotable dialogue? I have a lot of that movie memorized.
I love The Last Boy Scout. It's so good. It knows exactly what it is. I feel like that movie got panned when it came out. I could be wrong. Yeah.
It did. I mean, but I saw it four times in first run. I could not believe how fun it was. And the lines of dialogue are just seared into my mind. I love it.
Like what?
When they're being beaten up by that guy with his, who's well-spoken, and he says, Jake attacks his job with a certain exuberance. And Wayan says, shit, we're being beaten up by the inventor of Scrabble.
Yeah, that is a terrific movie. And Taylor is, Taylor was a friend, and I immediately thought in my head, I want to dedicate this book to him because I want people to remember him, you know? And he's been gone for almost 10 years now, but he's someone that either people on this podcast immediately know by name, or if they Google him, they will know him by name, or they'll know him by face, right? And by the way, Taylor, his character gets shot up by a machine gun. So this movie's came out in fall of 91, fall of 92, somewhere in there.
Christmas 91.
So I know T2 came out that summer, but we are getting away from the beefcake stuff at this point, right? I mean, it is going away slowly. But Milo, who was bad guy number two, Noble Willingham, who's the head baddie, but he's the old man. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if does he get killed in it?
He gets killed in it. He gets blown up.
How does he get killed?
He gets blown up.
He gets blown up. Oh, right. In the car. But Taylor's Milo, who's his number one henchman, who's the creepo with the knife or whatever, gets shot up with a machine gun, falls off the top ledge of the stadium. Into helicopter blades. Yes. I mean, just beautiful. Just beautiful.
Yeah, this is what we want when we go to movies. Totally. It's just so, but this is a roundabout way of saying that what I liked about your book is that you've got all the famous quotes from history, some context for what made them famous, but in fact, each one of us walks around with a movie memorized in our heads, you know, that we all have. You could practically do a book just about The Last Boy Scout.
I know.
You know, I'm sure that you were like me, that, you know, in your house, there were movies that people understood chapter and verse, and you could, you know, in my house, you know, we all knew very well most of the quotes from Plan 9 from Outer Space. So we would constantly bring that stuff up, you know.
Coming to America for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, not a year goes by that on my birthday, I don't immediately get a text in the morning that says, Happy birthday, Your Highness. But but along with, you know, the hundreds of other lines from that movie. I didn't want to wear myself out too much with like some sort of like,
but I like kind of thing.
Well, yeah. Or just having too much editorial logic, because in the end, like you can try to like make the case for why each line should exist, but you know, there is no view from nowhere, right? Like if you hired 100 people to write this book, you're going to get a different set. You probably will get like, if you said to them, like you need to do like the iconic lines of Hollywood history or whatever, everyone's probably going to do about 30% the same. Like they're going to do Chinatown, they're going to do Casablanca, blah, blah, blah. But we're all going to break off.
And you don't want it to be like the Turner Classic Movies version of movie quotes where, you know.
No, or the AFI.
The same 50 or 60 quotes we've all heard a million times.
Yeah. Well, that's bullshit. I mean, that's not what everyone knows, right? Yeah. Like Roger Mosley's monologue in The Mac, for instance, he gives this speech to Max Julian. It's toward the beginning of the film, and they sort of – I write about this, that they have they both express like their diverging ideologies. Like, you know, for those who haven't seen The Mac, it's about this guy Goldie, and he was played by Max Julian, and he's this pimp who gets out of prison and he wants to get back. Well, actually he gets out of prison and he becomes a pimp, and he just knows like that's the only way in life, that he's going to get his mom a house, that he's going to get out of the Oakland ghetto. And meanwhile, his brother Olinga, played by Roger Mosley, who was like the sidekick
on Magnum P.I.
In Magnum P.I., yeah. He's great. And, you know, he's like sort of the stand-in for like the Black Panther who's trying to organize like the neighborhood. And they go at it back and forth. And Mosley gives this speech that's famously sampled in 100 million hip-hop tracks. It starts with I think the line that people remember the most is him kind of going like, hey, man, you don't realize in order for us to make this thing work, we got to get rid of the pimps and the pushers and the prostitutes and then start all over again clean. And he says it much better than I do. But, you know, it's heard on, I mean, Dr. Dre's Rat-a-tat-tat on The Chronic and, you know, a number of other tracks. So like that to me is undoubtedly an iconic line. It just so happened to be a line that maybe did not reverberate under the households of everyone who was a member of the AFI or whoever compiles those sort of lists, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And Scarface has that role too. I mean, it was so heavily sampled in hip hop that we all know lots of lines from Scarface, but I don't think the AFI would consider that, you know, material for their 100 greatest lines. You know, they might say hello to my little friend would be the one they would pick, but no other lines.
You know, the AFI did. I mean, I don't want to like, you know.
Yeah, I don't mean to shit on the AFI.
Yeah. But they did. I mean, they've recognized this. Like they did like a 100 movie quotes a few years ago. And only recently, and I noticed this, I started writing this book in fall 2020. And at some point, I don't remember when, but they did put this sort of kind of apology banner on the top of the page if you go to it. And it's basically them saying like, shit, we're sorry that Sidney Poitier's line from In the Heat of the Night is literally the only person of color on this list. We're pieces of shit. We will do better. And like, okay, you know what? Good on them. Good on them. But it is, I mean, to everyone's point, right? It's like, it's just a matter of perception, you know? Mm-hmm. So I tried to keep that in mind. I mean, I actually feel bad that I selfishly, I couldn't help it. As a tortured cat dad, I included a line from The Long Goodbye, in which Elliot Gould's Philip Marlowe is at the grocery store. And the grocery clerk is like giving him a hard time about the brand of cat food. And anyway, if you know the exchange, you know the exchange. But it does connect to Raymond Chandler, too, and his whole relationship with cats. So I spent time on that as an entry rather than around that same time. So that's 73. In 72, Lady Sings the Blues comes out. And Billy Dee Williams has like a famous line where he says, you want my arm to fall off. And that's his introduction to Diana Ross as he's holding out a 20 with his arm extended. And it's this really sexy romantic moment of, that's also been referenced in like tons of films. And I look at that and I'm like, that should have been in there instead of the long goodbye, but I'm a piece of shit. So,
well, and not only that, you were savvy because the long goodbye is beloved by millennials in particular. I think millennials have figured out how good Altman is and how good in particular the long goodbye is. And partly because of what an influence it was on the Big Lebowski. They kind of feel to me like variations on a theme.
So I've been a little self-critical about how I curated the lines of the book as to whether the movies are skewed too old. If you look at the contents up front, I mean, you're going to see tons of lines from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Like from 2000 on, it gets light. And I don't really have any entries past 2000 that I necessarily go long on. And I kind of feel like that's a mistake, but I'm also aware that, you know, movies were no longer the center of culture, and therefore it's difficult to make the argument that, you know, that there is a line from Captain Phillips that deserves to be written about for multiple pages, or that right. Could you really what's the family quote from Fast and Furious? Like, could you really make an argument for like a conversation about why that line resonates and where? I mean, I'm sure someone could, but I also do have this feeling of like that people and younger generations too, like, are interested in repertoire films. Like, I do feel that. And so I don't really break myself. I don't bust myself up too much about it.
I'm trying to think of movies of the last few years that gave us all a lot of quotes. And I think the one with the most is Mean Girls. I think there's a lot of lines from Mean Girls that still have currency. And that movie's nearly 20 years old now.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I went with one. I went with Get In, Loser, We're Going Shopping. And I think I actually included the Taco Bell line in a list earlier on. I have like there's a few lists throughout. Don't get scared. It's not BuzzFeedy. I promise. It's just that, you got to have lists. Yeah. And I should add, by the way, that, I should add what the book isn't. And I don't really think listeners that have made it this far would assume it is this, but it's definitely not the book that's like, here's the section of movie lines you need if you need to, right? Like, yeah. It's not.
Here's some great pickup lines from movies.
Yeah. Like, that's definitely on Earth 2, that book exists. There's no, I mean, it probably exists anyway. But I didn't want to go. That would not be interesting to write or to read to me. I think you can still have you can make something else that's interesting and can be for yourself, or can just like gift it to you, like, you know, your dad or your aunt or whoever.
Also, your book doesn't have any soy banter in it. You don't have a "that just happened" section.
Is that soy banter? Is that, yeah. So that's funny. I would say I was hostile toward Marvel, but not unfair. I do have an item on the responsibility line from Spider-Man. I'm aware that's, you know, that's a line of dialogue that's been recycled and repurposed in like different generations of Spider-Man movies. And that deserves like a brief discussion. Wakanda Forever is in there. I'm not a complete asshole. but there was a moment in like I wrote about like twice as many. And, you know, I cut a ton, but the ones that I cut, regardless, if I end up just posting them to my letterbox or just like keeping them in a Google file, I'm fine with that, because the exercise of writing those alone still helped inform me on the ones that made it in the book in their own way. Yeah. But one was in the Avengers, Hulk says something like, you know, "Hey, Mr. Captain, I sure am angry all the time," or there's some line like that. "I'm always angry, Mr. Captain." And I wrote it and rewrote it. And I tried to find, like, there is a connection to Hulk being angry and what that means and back to the TV show and all that. But in the end, I'm like, you know what? Fuck off.
Yeah.
I didn't wake up and go like, oh, I can't wait to get all the superhero movie lines and discover their meaning.
Yeah, because you don't want to just be up there doing the jangling keys stuff and just saying, remember this line, and not saying
right.
the line, you know, because that's there's the problem just, right there.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much more interesting shit to dive into.
Yeah.
I guess if I did have a favorite line, well, I don't know. It's one of my favorites. I'm a huge fan of Hal Ashby and of Hal Ashby's shampoo. And I don't know the last time that you've seen it or not, but it's up there for me.
I love it.
Great. So Julie Christie has this line that was like a water cooler moment in 1975. I don't even know if water coolers existed in 1975, but it's when she's at the cocktail party,
they're all waiting for the results to watch Nixon win.
Yes. And, you know, it's this whole, comedy of manners where, you know, she wants to fuck Warren Beatty and Warren Beatty's worried because he sees his other girlfriend at the Goldie Hawn at the other table watching him, and Jack Warden's watching Warren, and it's all, nutty. And she kind of is getting hit on by this older man who's played by William Castle, who was this like kind of wacky, producer. Amazing 60s producer director. And, you know, she antagonizes him when he asks her, like, you know, if he can get her anything. And she says, well, most of all, I'd like to suck his cock. And she points a thumb at Warren Beatty. And it was like this shocking moment in 1975, despite the fact that like profanity was, you know, totally like mainstreamed in movies at that point. And
yeah,
it was really fun to dig into that and sort of look at the reactions as to why. And a shocker, I mean, a big reason was because a woman had said the line, and that was just sort of,
groundbreaking.
But I don't mean to leave it on like this note of like, oh, and thank God the girl bosses can now say my cock or whatever. But it's more that like, I mean, you have to see Shampoo to really kind of to understand why it struck. But in Hollywood, at all the previews, I mean, the movie's about Warren Beatty, who is this like Lothario or hairdresser who's running around town and, you know, sleeping with all these wealthy women. And, I think that a lot of women apparently like directors' wives and the like, and, you know, women like Santa Barbara, they felt seen on some level. Mm-hmm. When that movie came out, like they didn't like the idea of being called out as like these kind of bored, you know, bored, beautiful women and trapped in paradise who live these like vapid sex lives. It was something like that. Mm-hmm. We should probably cut all this shit out, actually.
Well, Brian, congratulations again on your new book out this week. You Talking to Me, The Definitive Guide to Iconic Movie Quotes. I'll put a link in the show description for my listeners to be able to grab a copy. Brian, thank you so much for joining me and getting me to watch Junior Bonner. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Let's watch it again next week. I mean, I would. I probably will.
We'll have a weekly Junior Bonner episode on the podcast.
Yeah, that won't diminish your listening you know, numbers at all, will it? Yeah. No, but maybe Cross of Iron.
Yeah, yeah. I do have a copy of it. I should watch Cross of Iron again.
If I could get like a nice tight print of it, I'm sure I should just like buy the fucking DVD or order it on Prime. I should do that. I should give it another chance. That is another movie that apparently he was sober during the making of. And I'm not saying that being sober automatically makes it a good movie, but you know,
kind of helps maybe. A little bit.
It wouldn't hurt. Yeah.
On the other hand, the Osterman Weekend is the work of somebody who's not sober.
That was bad. That was bad. I don't think he had much control over it either, though. I think they took it out of his hands.
Sort of work print that was included on one of the DVDs of the original cut, it's too late. This movie's bad. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, he's done. He was done at that point.
His last works were two Julian Lennon music videos. That's what he did before he died.
Those, were those just like pity hires at that point?
I don't know. But what a career. What a way to go out.
I mean, you know, what are you going to do?
Before we go, I just want to express my very best wishes for full health and full recovery to friend of the show, Matt Christman. This podcast does have a Patreon, and patrons get access to bonus episodes every month. To become a patron and to get access to these episodes, including more of this podcast's Miami Vice series, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter. And please follow us on Twitter at junkfilterpod. We'll have another episode in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you for listening.